This is the User Experience Hamburg Radio. Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear festival audience, I'm delighted to introduce Ken Doctor for this very intimate presentation and talk. Ken Doctor is a well-known media consultant and a speaker. He has 35 years of experience, and I think, 21 of which you spend at Knight Ridder in various positions. And he also is the author of a book called Newsonomics, very interesting. It's also the title of his blog and his weekly column at Nieman Journalism Lab. They syndicate it, and it's give a very interesting read every week into your insights. I think we first met at a conference called The World Beyond Advertising in Düsseldorf. Yeah, several years ago. And since then, I had the pleasure to meet you over several occasions. So I'm very pleased to, that we'll be listening to your insights today and that we have the pleasure to have a fireside talk right afterwards. So there will be no break between your talk and our discussion, and this discussion will be the interactive part. And please take interactive literally. We hope to have many interesting contributions from you. So please welcome Ken Doctor.
Crossover. I come out of the news industry. I worked in the news industry for many years. And now I cover really transformation of media in general, focusing on news, text news, newspaper news, broadcast news, magazines, and I've gotten more and more into other media types, movies, music, books, and TV. And what's been amazing to me as I've studied this over the last couple of years is how similar all these trends are across media, much more similar than different. So this is where I think we are. I think this is where we are as consumers and as media people. We are crossing over. We have no idea where we're going. We'll talk about the cast of characters, this age crossover, who is crossing over, and the money. I follow the money because the money determines what we in the media get to produce, who pays us, and what we as consumers get to see and listen and read. So this is a theme you're going to see throughout the presentation: discovery, access, sharing, and organization. These are the things that we're all grappling with, and media companies are grappling with, and as digital consumers, we want to find new things. We want better access. We now expect that we turn on any digital device or we hit that little triangular play button on video that it will work, and it will work instantly. And I think everybody in this room can remember 3 and 5 and 7 and 9 years ago when that wasn't the case. This stuff kind of worked some of the time, and it was magic that it worked, and now our expectation is it will all work all the time. Sharing, of course, is a part of the fabric. And then organization. How do we deal with all of this stuff that is now available to us? So let's look at some. Is this working? Let's stop. It's in and out. Okay. So let's look at some of the major digital business figures of our time through a Hollywood lens. I had some fun with some of these images. This was the Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments movie. I'm going to keep talking to you to figure out what's right. Okay. It's okay. Can we turn this one off?
So this is a 1950s movie out of Hollywood. This is Charlton Heston in The Ten Commandments, the original tablet according to Hollywood. And then this is the inheritor, Rupert Murdoch, who still runs the largest news company in the world. The tablet, The Daily, his publication came out, and it's already gone. One of the more expensive early R&D projects in mobile. And then we have some legendary figures building up. We have the CEO of Google, King Kong. They dominate digital advertising around the world. 40-45% of all the digital advertising in the world goes to Google. And for Mark Zuckerberg, life is good. Facebook, upside, upside, upside. Arianna Huffington has made her inroads into Europe with various partnerships now and still runs the fifth most used news site in the U.S. Tina Brown, endless change. First she did Daily Beast, then she did Newsweek, Newsweek cratered. She had a parting of the ways with Daily Beast about 3 weeks ago and is now onto a new thing in digital, which is physical events. Those two things don't seem to go together, but they do. And then Arthur Sulzberger, the New York Times, put in a paywall that is changing access to news and news organizations around the globe. Schibsted, this little Oslo-based company, is now the sixth largest news company in the world. CEO Rolf Risstad is leading that charge. Al Jazeera just opened a branch in the United States, 850 journalists hired, which is a huge number, and a huge number anywhere in the West these days. This guy, Daniel Ek, Spotify, changing the world of music, very similar to his peers. This was Walter Cronkite, who was the dean of American Newsmen, and this is the state of graphics in 1969. Up here, he is showing the moon landing. He's using cardboard. He's now been replaced by Jon Stewart. Now, Jon Stewart will say, I'm only a comic. I'm not really a news guy. Yet 3 million people a day really depend on Jon Stewart for the news of the day. Let's talk a little about some more examples of media blur. So there's this guy in the middle there, the non-fuzzy one, Gary Nell, who was CEO of NPR, National Public Radio, which is listened to by 30 million Americans every week. Huge player in news in the United States. He just left to go to the National Geographic Company, a very old company, a magazine company that is trying to get digital. Where'd he come from? He came from Sesame Street. He is one of the best examples of media blur. Here he's coming from television. Then he's going to radio as radio itself is morphing digital. And he's going to magazines. That skill set among executives is very much wanted. And this is National Public Radio, but this is National Public Radio on the tablet. You see a little, it's hard to see maybe distantly, there's a little audio symbol there for stories. Half the stories you can't listen to because they are actually written stories. So this is another sign of morphing. New York Times, I got some interesting numbers from them recently. I wonder how many stories are in the New York Times. Well, about 150 daily, 350 on Sunday. But on a daily basis now, 124 blog posts. And you all remember a time when bloggers were still made fun of and people talked about pajama-clad bloggers and blogging would never work. The New York Times will soon be at a point where it is writing more blog posts every day than it is actual stories. So let's get into this age of crossover. This is what a lot of us feel like these days. And this is a movement from analog to digital and physical to virtual in every field we can think about. Video stores used to be ubiquitous on the landscape. Blockbuster here, largest one in the U.S., killed all the competition and then died itself. Tower Records, one of the largest, killed much competition. It's gone. Borders, number two bookstore, barely survived for a long time, and then it closed its doors. Barnes & Noble, the last one standing, is having its own problems. Electronic stores. So Best Buy killed all its competition. There used to be five or six of these big box electronic stores. And then people started to say, I can get this stuff online a little cheaper. I don't have to talk to the annoying salespeople. I'm not going to go in there. We'll push them off to the side. They're trying to survive. And then newspapers. 15 newspapers died last year in the U.S. beyond all of those that have continued to get skinnier and skinnier. So this is the movement. Let's look at some numbers. There are probably not, I bet there's no one in this crowd that has a dumb phone. And now more than half the people across the world have smartphones. And this is an introduction of smartphones that happened really at the Palm Pilot maybe 9-10 years ago. But really, iPhone made a huge difference here. And now already a majority of phones are smartphones. For Amazon, if you are a Kindle owner, you buy four times more books than if you only buy print books. A fast movement, and the more here is very important. For Warner Music, third largest music company, it is now selling more digital music than physical music. That crossover was last year. AM radio, 15% of the listening that goes on today is on AM radio. Back in its heyday, 1978, half of all listening. And the big thing in terms of money, digital ad spending is surpassing print. It did it last year globally, in the U.S., Brazil, Australia, and Russia, all in that year. Across Northern Europe, it has generally passed it in 2010 and 2011. So what's the model of the day that connects all this change in media? It is all access. So we have Spotify, we have Sky, we have Netflix. We have Morgan Post, recently sold by Springer. We have Financial Times. We have HBO. We have all of these different kinds of companies all doing the same thing and saying the same thing to customers. And this is a proposition we didn't know would work 3, even 4 years ago. And it's very simple. And these companies are all saying to us as consumers, we have stuff you want, right? And we nod and say yes. And we will now get it to you on any device you want. Instantaneously, it's magic, don't worry about it, and you just pay us this one-time monthly price. And every month you pay us, we'll get you our stuff. It's working. And you all remember a time as well where our slogan was that the internet wants to be free. Well, we're moving profoundly from a time of free to a time of paid, and this is the model. Spotify's model is the same, of course, and very similar here. You can listen free. So there's this free or freemium movement. Get a little, ad-supported. But if you really like a service, whether it's Spotify or Netflix or the others that are up there, you got to pay. So you pay some for web access, but you really want all access. So the deal on the right, which is 10 euro. You can keep it under, it's actually 9.99. You keep it under 10, you do a 99 cent sampling. That's the model across all media. We're now even seeing it in books. Oyster just announced that it's going to offer 100,000 books for the price of $9.99 in the U.S. starting sometime in early 2014. It's all the same from all these companies. One big question in my world, what about Netflix for news? How soon is this going to come? We know that news is very different because it's a stream. It changes all the time. It's not like an album or a movie. But Flipboard's working on it, among others. So let's look at the money and what's happened in money. Big numbers here. 39% decline in newspaper revenues over this five-year period ending last year. That's a difference on an annual basis of $51 billion. The news industry worldwide still is much larger than almost any other business in media. TV is, of course, right up there, but among the others. $51 billion less earned in 2012 than in 2007. 39% decline and still going down. So where did it go? Well, $99 billion. So you take that $51 billion, and you can add to it, $99 billion has gone to digital advertising. Those in the print trade like to say, well, you know, there's print dollars and there's digital dimes, and there's not enough digital dimes to pay the journalists because there's not enough money in digital advertising. This is the 2012 year-end number, $99 billion. But who's getting it? Google, Microsoft, AOL, Yahoo, and Facebook. They take two-thirds of that money, so more than $63 billion a year is going to those five companies. You'll notice that those companies do not create content. They redistribute content. So free is moving to pay in the world of media. In newspapers, more than 500 dailies have moved to paywalls already, and many more are in process. And this is against a number in 2011 of probably a dozen to two dozen. So fast movement. The old choice. Well, you could buy a newspaper and have it, in most countries, delivered to your door for $200, $300, $400 a year. Or you could get that same news on a website for free. Now, when we write this history, people will be amazed and they'll say, that was the old choice. How come everybody didn't leave print and just go to free digital? And it's the power of habit. So circulation did decline, but it was declining 1, 2, 3, 4% a year. That's the 2010 choice. The 2013 choice? Well, pay me $300 to $500 a year. Pricing has gone up across the Western world as well. 20%, 30%. I've seen huge price increases in single years. So pay me $300 to $500 a year. And you know that old free digital content? That's now included in that price. It's a huge change that we've seen in a three-year period. It's happening in magazines as well. The New Yorker, of course, one of the better magazines in the world, just $39 in 2010, and now as much as $99 for print plus digital in 2013. Huge increase, and it is growing, not just revenue, but readers. People, Time Inc.'s biggest magazine company in the U.S., People had said until a month ago, if you pay your money for your magazine subscription, then we'll throw in digital and you just put in this little authentication code. And now they're saying, nope, there's three or four different offers and they're charging a lot more and they're making the offers more diverse, trying to get VIP customers. So what's happened to music that's parallel? Well, free is moving to pay. So if you look at these revenues, now this is a longer time period, 1999 to 2012, but the decline here was 43% in the global music industry in terms of music sales. It was all sales, physical and digital. 43%. A similar decline. Decline in news was 39% over 5 years, but you're seeing a similar decline in media. And where it's at today is $16.5 billion. What's as significant here in terms of this crossover that I cover is that in 2012, music revenue actually grew globally 0.3%, which was the first time it had grown since 1999. I'm very familiar with this number, 0.3%. New York Times grew last year 0.3% its own revenue. It had crossed over from losses of 6 years because it started charging for digital access. It had crossed over and made a little plus revenue year over year, 0.3%. So we can see how much these trends are common. 34% of the revenue in the music industry is digital. The news industry, it's about 20-25% at this point. So the audience has moved. The audience always moves ahead of the money. The audience is moving. And we're getting to a point, 25-34%, a quarter to a third of the revenue of these legacy industries is coming along. Key point for both news and for music, when do they hit 50%? So we have 75% of the audience for music is now, actually should not say streaming there, but it's mobile. Mobile listening is 75% of music. Just an incredible number. In the news industry, because it's different, only 30% at this point, but growing rapidly. But streaming is 10%. And streaming is going to be one of the greatest changes, both in terms of our habits, but also the business models going forward. And yet, all of this is paywalls 1.0. Much of this stuff used to be free. It's now going to be paid. It's going on this all-access model. We're going on the paywalls 2.0. Companies, medium-sized and large, are trying to figure out how to get us to pay more. Jeff Bezos, head of Amazon, has just bought the Washington Post. That's what he's focused on. We have this tremendous movement from public companies in the U.S., and even in Germany, as Springer has sold your daily here in Hamburg, and its daily in Berlin to Funke Media. Media can't make it, at least newspapers can't make it as public companies now, because there's too much pressure of change, there's too much pressure of crossover, so they're going into private hands. And this movement to sell things, now we're even seeing TV starting to sell. This is a show that's on FX network in US, and it's called The Bridge. Actually came out of Denmark and Sweden, adapted in the US. And all the ads on TV during this show are for the sale of its interactive book, which is in Spanish and English. We're going to see TV companies selling a lot more digital products. Mark Thompson, the new CEO of the New York Times, talks about working the engagement curve. So the translation of that, we all touch the New York Times a lot of times during the day and the week, and he wants to figure out how he can make money from us when we're touching. Instead of one payment once a month, he wants us to be able to pay for more things more often. And this is essentially the mantra of every media company CEO in the world. Sell more stuff. So who is crossing over? Well, we have the consumers crossing over, we have creators crossing over, and we have companies crossing over. So if we look at consumers here, everybody's trying to figure out how this is working, and it's very, very confusing because it's different by generation, it's different by country, it's different by media type. But we have some of my favorite archetypes are loyalists. there are people who really love their medium. And in print, these are people who will pay a lot more for a daily newspaper. And it looks like daily newspapers may cost twice what they did even 5 years ago, but still have a very loyal following. So every medium has a loyalist. And then there are straddlers. Well, I kind of like the old way, but I like the new way as well, and I'm going to try to do both, and I'm not quite sure, and I just don't have enough time in my day. And there are swivelers. That's many of us, I think, who are going around, we're trying this, we're dabbling here, through the day, through the month, our habits have not yet settled down. And there are converts. One of the interesting statistics about tablets is that there are many people who have adopted news reading on tablets and given up the daily newspaper far more quickly than people thought. So lending us to believe the tablet may actually be a replacement for print reading and news reading. So how many converts will there be, and how do you satisfy all these different kinds of people at this time of great transition? So what do we want as consumers? Okay, so we're back to discovery. Well, we all say to somebody, have you seen this? Well, we want to know about this. This is new. This is a great story, a great app, a great service. We want discovery. We don't want to seem like we don't know what's going on. Very important. Access. As I said earlier, we expect instant access. It now seems to be our God-given right to be able to get at anything, any media type, from anywhere in the world, instantly on our smartphone. Sharing. Social is just built into everything we do at this point. And organization. And this is really the toughest part of it at this point. How do you figure out what you're going to do in a given day? How do you figure out what you're reading, what you want to share, where your work life ends and your leisure life begins? This is the key problem that many consumers have. This report is now about a year old, but I just love this report because if you read it, it just drives you crazy. People are moving between smartphones and tablets and PCs and TVs in about 74 different ways. And they're going off in different kinds of patterns beyond second screen usage, and it is impossible for media organizations to figure out. What we do know are these new numbers that just came out this last week. In the U.S., and this is a period of February 2010, February 2013, the number of internet minutes that Americans spent almost doubled. This is on a monthly basis. Just incredible. A doubling of minutes. Well, why? Well, we kind of know why. Smartphones. So back in old 2010, a long time ago now, right? 63 billion minutes a month spent. Up to 308 billion minutes. And tablets, which were basically brand new back then, up to 115 billion. But overall, a doubling of the number of minutes. Now, before that, most of the people who were going to get online had gotten online, and we had seen some leveling off of usage. No one predicted this. A sign in the music industry, Pandora, up year over year, 16% in listening hours. And let's remember, this is all before connected cars. Connected cars in the U.S., Pandora is being built into many, many models of cars at this point. Google wants to control the interface in cars. Ford says, no, thank you. We want to control the interface. We'll do our own partnerships. This is another global battle that is going on. But this will greatly increase our internet access to everything. And we have to even think about what we mean by that word mobile. I think mobile actually is a fairly obsolete word. We're all expecting we have the internet anywhere we go. And in fact, it turns out that almost half of mobile usage, meaning smartphones and tablets, is done at home right now. So does it make much difference in terms of definition if we're sitting in front of a
desktop,
a laptop, a TV, or a smartphone? Well, we know the form factor makes it different, but the location is all the same. Next crossover that we are all living in the midst of, but many companies haven't really come to grips with, is the coming mobile majority. BBC just had its first weekend where a majority of the people coming to its sites came from mobile about a month ago. So a number of things have happened. It had been in the 40 percentiles. By 2015, news sites will be mobile majority. They're at about a third right now. As we said, with music, it's 75% and growing. Now, this is where we've come. Desktop love. We actually love these huge boxes at one point for what they could do. But desktop is now the new print. And desktop minutes are actually decreasing slowly right now, and I think fairly soon at a more rapid rate. To mobile addiction. This is a one-way move. The internet is simply with us. So for creators, we're back to these kind of questions. How do I discover new audiences? How do I get access to those audiences? Who owns the pipes? Who owns the way to get to the audiences? We know that social is a great way for people to sample and to sample cheaply, but it is very difficult for most creators across media to build large audiences off social. It's a great discovery mechanism. Sharing, again, good, but tough to build a big business. And then organization. How do you become part of someone's habit? In the news world, we see bigness works. We also see a number of more cooperative efforts. So here's an interesting company called Global Post. Has about 30 correspondents around the world, does international news reporting, and is close to profit-making after 4 or 5 years at this point. What it has done is joined with a larger company, NBC News, as a big brother. That kind of relationship, smaller companies working with larger companies to get access, to make sure they're discovered, is something we're going to see more as this ecosystem evolves. And then California Watch. This is foundation funded. This is a nonprofit. It has 60 journalists working for it. And they have been able to produce great journalism over the last 3 or 4 years, finding a niche of basically distributing their content through newspapers and radio stations and TV stations in California. So we see different forms of organization here. And I think we will see these in other media as well, studios and other forms of organization developing. The companies. I've talked about the Digital Dozen for a while. Companies, TV companies like these, web companies like these, and print companies like these. These are companies that have global reach. We know one of the things the internet does is it knocks down national boundaries. So if you are big and if you have global distribution, you have incredible economy of scale. That's why these companies all have much greater potential than local companies or smaller companies. And then there is what I call GAFA, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. Now, we know that these companies, or a couple of these companies and Microsoft, are dominating advertising, but as we talk about media and media sales, let's look where they're going. Google Play, it's been out there for a few years, starting to get some traction. So Google's saying, of course, don't depend on us just for search and for 16 other things in your lives, including mapping, but we want to be your media player. We want to be the middleman. Apple says, no, remember iTunes? Well, now iTunes Radio. You really don't need Spotify or Deezer or Pandora. Apple iTunes is everything you need in music. Facebook, not yet selling much music directly or media directly. It will. There's a lot of music being sold by it. It's not taking a cut of it yet. It will. And then, of course, Amazon going that same direction. Amazon, which is really a huge store, now makes more than 50% of its revenues on selling media. The middlemen. So, where do middlemen fit into this? Where do they help us find what we want? Where are they in access? Where are they in the sharing process? And do they help us organize this world? We know that the classic idea of internet creation, well, you have creative people and you have consumers, and what digital is supposed to do is knock out that middle layer, all the wholesalers and distributors that exist in the physical world. Well, it's creating new ones. Maybe apps could come to the rescue, and you have apps like ShowU and dozens of other apps that are really attempting to help us organize and reorganize our lives among this infinity of choices that we now have in media every day. But what I think is likely to happen is this: the battle of big. So we have the gap of forces on the one hand. And these, the might of these companies, the market power of these companies, is still underestimated. They are all West Coast companies where I live. They are changing the culture of the West Coast. You have people like Jeff Bezos now buying an old Eastern institution like the Washington Post. But they are global forces, and they want to be in the middle of all of our lives, selling us all media, organizing media for us as well. So I wanted to stop there, and we get into discussion on some of these topics, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ken. Do we have another working microphone? That would be great. There are some people in the dark. You can see us, but we cannot see you. This is not very polite. We have enough space up here. Please come on up. This is where the audience belongs. We'll make this more cozy for you. Please come on up. Just wait until the commotion settles. Well, it was just this faint movement. Where would you like to sit? Okay, then I sit here.
How long did you sit in the dark?
No, they sneaked in. They're recording, and then it's always easier to understand with the mic. And so, thank you very much, Ken. This was very insightful. You ended with the battle of big. I wonder if you also see chances for small, for niche and unique.
Yeah, and I think in terms of creation especially, there will be all kinds of small creation going on, the idea of individuals and studios and using digital techniques to be able to reach audiences. I think what I see happening, and I see this most clearly in the world of news, is, and that's why I want to include a couple of those quick examples of Global Post and the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can be an individual creator, and you can figure out how to create really good stuff, but you need help getting to markets. So social gets you so far, I think. It gets you discovered. But to be able to reach large enough audiences that have enough money, I think you need essentially a big brother, big sister relationship with companies that have that kind of audience. Now those companies, take this example of Global Post. Global Post has been out there, has built a good website, probably about the 40th biggest news website in the U.S., but not yet profitable. And they looked at it and they said, well, what do we need from NBC? We want to stay independent. We don't want to sell. And they said, well, we want promotion. So on NBC sites, and NBC is now global itself, has six major kinds of sites. NBC is featuring Global Post content, which gets them eyeballs and distribution. And then they said, well, we're selling advertising, but we're not selling that much advertising, and we're not selling it at a high enough rate. Advertising today is all about technology, the matching of audiences to advertiser wants, targeting audiences. We want access to the NBC ad platform. So that deal worked on, we want audience, we want advertising platform. And I think it is very symbolic of the kinds of deals that will be out there across media, where if you are a big company, if you're an NBC, you're paying more than twice as much for a reporter as Global Post is paying. Global Post reporters in the U.S. make about $60,000 a year. So they make a living wage, they're doing well, but NBC would have to pay those people $120,000 a year. NBC gets the advantage of lower cost, high quality content. And I think I can see that developing in music, movies, TV. Independents work, but they evolve new relationships with the big guys.
Please remember that this is the interactive part. This is where you come in. So anytime you have a question, there's a microphone, just chime in. You don't have to wait till the end. What about, is this the age of the freelancer, the age of the entrepreneurial-minded journalist? Do you see chances there too at the very small nucleus?
Yeah, I mean, the ability to, you know, what we know in storytelling is the incredible democratization of storytelling. So anybody with a computer and access to WordPress can write and can find an audience. We also know that, I think of it as a pyramid, that you have at the top of that pyramid, you have full-time paid staff. That's the way the world used to work in journalism. People aspired to a middle-class job, a full-time job. And now there is a lot underneath that pyramid. I think that the ability to get into the business and the ability, especially for young people who don't have a lot of financial obligations, to find niches, find their passion, and do really good work, usually at fairly low wages, usually doing three or four different kinds of things, is unparalleled. We haven't had a time like that in, well, probably forever, but you'd have to go back before World War II to think of that, of writers and journalists working that way. So getting into it, I think, is easier, far easier. Getting to the top is far harder. And what is developing, but hasn't quite developed yet, and it's so new and all of these changes are new, is really the middle. So what is the middle? Where you can earn a decent living creating media. And that's a lot harder question to answer, I think, in 2013.
Let's stick with your underlying figure of speech, the blur, for a while, yeah. The media blur. You've come up with a lot of interesting examples of the economic model blurring, the business model,
yep,
blurring, and the technology blur. There were some examples too.
Yep.
Do you also see a blur of journalism in a good or a bad way?
Oh, there's all kinds of blurs going on. I mean, one of the main blurs going on is in an age of storytelling, which is, I think, where we are, all these tools to tell stories in text, with video, with audio, with animations, visualizations. These tools now can be used by anybody, and in fact, anybody's a publisher. Well, anybody being a publisher also means that major corporations are publishers. So over the last year, the major blur that has been or beginning to be hotly contested is what we call content marketing. In content marketing, if you're Orange Telecom, or if you are Procter & Gamble, you say, we're now a publisher. We can get a lot of people to come to our websites, but when they get there, we don't want to just give them coupons. We want them to have an actual reading experience. And they're going to news companies and saying, you know how to create actual experiences where people like to come someplace and stop and read for a while. So the blur between commercial storytelling and storytelling for the purpose of selling somebody something through a company, and the purpose of journalism, which is to inform people without fear or favor, that blur is the one that is most on my mind right now. Now, I don't think shutting the door, as in all things digital, works, because you can't shut the door. But what you can do is draw a very clear line between what is editorial storytelling, which is done on behalf of the reader, and everything else, which is done for commercial motives.
Forbes and BuzzFeed and lots of other media seem to be doing, but especially BuzzFeed and Forbes seem to be doing really well with this kind of blur.
Yeah.
Do you think this is legitimate? Because wouldn't the consequences otherwise be that media companies do their own content marketing, bypassing the media altogether? Like Red Bull has someone jump from the stratosphere,
sure.
Coca-Cola
sure.
has their own magazine, this kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think both of those are true. I was talking to the people at Hearst Magazines, and Hearst Magazines has been doing content marketing over the last 2 years. They talked to major advertisers, and advertisers have said, especially for the tablet, they said, we need your help in storytelling on the tablet. And they said, okay, we'll do that, and here's the price, and we'll help you with that storytelling. Already in that two-year period, the number of requests that they're getting is going down because these major companies and the agencies are learning how to do it themselves. So this may be a brief period. Now, we have companies, not just BuzzFeed and Forbes, but the Washington Post, the New York Times, many local newspaper companies getting into this field. I think most of them will fall out of it because they won't be well enough organized or executed to create the excellence that commercial storytellers want. Some will stay in it, and I think these lines are going to have to be worked out. Now, Forbes and BuzzFeed are the squishiest in terms of their lines. And this question of what's sponsored content and what's editorial content is something that the audience knows if it's disclosed. So we're back to really old questions of journalism. And these aren't just digital questions. I visited Times of India in Delhi about 6 months ago. Most successful newspaper company, probably media company of all of India. Its front section has about 3 or 4 pages of news. And that's the stuff that you kind of know is there, put there by the editors without any kind of commercial influence. The entire rest of the paper has commercial influence and no disclosure. And they've been doing this for 20, 25 years. So this isn't a digital problem, but the digital means lets us do a kind of dishonest blur, I think, with readers. And this is one of many areas where I think journalists need to assert themselves as to what they do and how it's different from simply selling goods or services.
I have a quick question concerning the one thing you were talking about before in terms of blur. We had this panel with Annette Novak from Sweden yesterday, and she was talking about how at the newspaper Norran they did like a Christmas market. And that was one of their ways to pull in their audience and to just engage with them. Is that a good blur in your philosophy, or is that a bad blur?
To me, that's fine, and that's part of what I've written about the events business, for instance. So I think that, and Annette talked a lot about community and how newspapers especially need to be a part of their community. They need to do more than, as she said, you know, go out and report on a fire, go back to the office and write it up. And so the idea of a sponsored event is fun. The question would be, you can take that as an example. You do a sponsored event, that doesn't mean you do a front page story with a big photo on it as if it's the most important thing that happened in that city that day. So the newspapers, magazines are still creatures of their communities. It's just very important in that what they write is demarcated as for the audience and not determined, directed, or influenced by advertisers. And that's the line that is being severely tested by the kinds of examples that we've talked about.
Name is Garrett Kolb. I'm running a company called Core Media. And we're basically a platform for most of the Axel Springer, and everybody's using our platform for actually doing this stuff, all that stuff. But what I'm interested in is, like, why are you drawing the line between two questions. One, why are you drawing the line between the blur of journalism so tightly? Because if you look at Red Bull, they're a media company right now. And they're not talking about Red Bull anytime. They're basically just doing air races. They're doing sky jumps. So basically, it's more the content collection that they have versus running infomercials. The same thing is true if you're talking about a company called Whiskey and Soda, like a red hot fashion company in Amsterdam. The guy that runs the company has been quoted with, "I'm not spending a single dime on advertising because I'm doing I'm a media company," and I think. There's space, so instead of drawing like such a line between like everything you do is infomercial, whatever you can do in media is either infomercial or is journalism, where I think it's really important to draw that line, not to confuse people about like the content quality that they have. But I think there's also a huge space specifically for local musicians and for people that are hyper-local to actually interact with the media strategies of local companies, because I think the buying powers of the local followers that they have would be much benefiting from local media collections of local brands. And so I guess what I'm saying is that I don't see like black and white. I see a lot of very, very credible, very valuable gray in the middle. Is that something you'd share?
No, I do. I do share that. And I'm pretty familiar with Red Bull, for instance. And so the content that they create, great content. The differentiation I'm making there is between media in general, which is, you know, has, as you're pointing out, I mean, incredible renaissance, and we're at the beginning of that renaissance, and news media. So Red Bull would not pretend that it's trying to inform you as its main intent. It's trying to reinforce the Red Bull brand and, of course, its products. And I think that's a critical differentiation in news. I think that to Carolyn's example of the event and what you're talking about with local musicians, for instance, the ability of of news media even to participate much more fully in their communities. For instance, you know, local newspapers digitally with music has been sorely underused and could be used. Now, that's different than if you're going to review a concert. If you're going to, as a reader, if we're reading a review of a concert, all we want is an honest assessment. Whoever's writing it's an honest assessment if it's presented as news. That doesn't mean that you couldn't have a division in a news company that would work. You could have five people working in the local music industry and make your site a center for music innovation. And I think we as readers are smart enough to understand the difference. I also think that what news media need to do is both fully embrace community and assert and disclose to their readers what's what of what they're putting out there. They should be producing a lot more content, co-producing content, partnering for content. But they also need to be able to say and disclose, this is what this is what that is. It's not that hard to do, but they're not doing it.
You've mentioned communities. Do you think communities are something that could be a foundation of a new business model? There's this one interesting example that comes to my mind, Voice of San Diego, foundation funded. But the foundation money is slowly running out, so they had to come up with new models. And one way they do it is they sell memberships. Tiered memberships. For $5 a month, you get a little bit. For $100 a month, you get a lot more. And especially what you get is access to people, to local influencers. Do you think, what's the one called in Honolulu, founded by
Silverbeat?
Yeah. It's interesting. The content is free, but you have to pay to comment in depth. You can do a little commenting on Facebook, but if you want to take part in in-depth discussions, it's $20 a month. So what do you think about these models?
This is one of the things that I'd love to see work, but I don't think will work.
Why not?
It's simply a game of numbers. So Voice of San Diego is a great site. And San Diego particularly has a pretty mediocre daily newspaper, which is, if you're running an independent news organization, is exactly what you want to compete against. But San Diego is a small town. San Diego, compared to New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, national companies of one kind or another. So what we've learned on membership, voluntary membership, MinPost is another one in the Twin Cities which has done it, is that it will get you so far. It might get you 20% of the revenue you need to pay enough journalists to have enough presence. But there's simply not enough people at this point willing to pay enough to largely support it. So I think it's part of a business model. Another example we can talk about would be Texas Tribune. So Texas Tribune is another nonprofit, very good site, very good reporting, some of the best journalism in Texas, which badly needs to be covered. They have members, but their memberships are maybe 10, 15, maybe 20% of their money. They're also in the events business we were talking about. They're producing a lot of events. They're making money off events. They're getting sponsorships from a lot of significant corporations in Texas. And so they have a business model that incorporates community but is not dependent on community. And to me, this is a question of scale. There is no doubt that this is a golden age of creativity where anybody can create because of the access to digital media. But scale, especially in the news industry, these are areas that are different industry by industry, not as true in music, but in news, you need scale. If you're going to cover an area, you need more than one person. There are plenty of one-person shops doing blogging and coverage. They have a little impact. Journalism organizations, by the nature of them, have enough heft that they can cover a story, they can cover a bunch of stories, and that their voice is recognized by power in communities. So to me, this question of funding, whether it's community, events, sponsorship, etc., is a question of how do you have enough scale to be a medium that people know and respect. And this, of course, is where newspapers got to with a different medium and a different ton.
There's a question up there.
Hi, what do you think about business models like SpotUs?
You couldn't get the last few words here.
Is a business model like SpotUs?
Like
SpotUs, the funding site, David Cohn founded.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's akin to this community model. It's something that we would think would work, but it has only worked to a limited degree. And so, and I think the difference is, if you look at Kickstarter initiatives in general, you have a single goal, and you say we want to do these water pumps in East Africa for this village, and it's going to be $100,000. The tangible goal, you know what $100,000 is going to get you. You can see people. You can finish that project. With SpotUs, you could fund one project. But in general, journalism is different. Journalism is a stream. And what we really want, and I think what we want as journalists and what we want as readers, is we want to have a known news organization, a group of people, however they are funded, wherever they come from, who we've gotten to know and trust, and then we want them to cover stories over time. So I think it makes it harder to do a Kickstarter kind of model, because we're talking about larger funding, ongoing funding, and you can't draw a picture as easy of the pumps in East Africa as you can of the kind of journalism that we need to do 6 months from now and a year from now. So this model I talked about of Center for Investigative Reporting is very interesting. They started with about 20 people, and they put out a it's run by Robert Rosenthal, who used to be the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And this is his latest career, and I knew him from the Knight Ridder days. He's having the most fun with it. he was able to hire the best people from daily newspapers who willingly left daily newspapers. These weren't people who were laid off or bought out. They left because they said, the newsrooms are depressing places. Everybody's talking about loss and who's gone today and all that kind of stuff. Here's the place that is growing and is wholly focused on journalism. They've now grown it from 30 to 60 people. They were Pulitzer finalists. And I've been in their offices, and they're the creating, I think, to me, they're the new way. They're putting together money, largely foundation at this point, but they're also getting television contracts and stuff. And they're building a core of a news group. And that core of a news group is excited about the storytelling tools that they have. They're using not just video and audio, but they're using comic books to tell stories for kids. They're using the tools of the day. They're differently funded. And if we had that kind of organization in every state in the U.S., journalism would be different. We only have it in two or three at this point. And I don't see it much across Europe. I may not know about it, but I haven't heard about it much. So the idea, I think, I'm really interested there is in a kind of studio model of journalism. And a studio model of journalism says, we know what we're doing, and you know, we have experience. We're not 22-year-olds coming out of college for a first job. CIR, for instance, is largely people in their 30s and 40s, 10, 15 years of experience. But we know what we want to do. We know what we want to cover. We're going to get some people to get us the money and the foundation. And then we're going to be part of, as I was saying at the beginning, about this ecosystem. We're going to be part of this ecosystem, do great stories, use video, audio, animation, use the tools of the day, and then we're going to use the wider ecosystem to get that story on TV stations in Los Angeles and San Francisco, to get it in the LA Times and the Sacramento Bee, as well as in the Hispanic Press. So they're using all of this distribution that's out there that hadn't been out there before. They're getting some money from those news outlets, but at the core, they are a studio producing unique content. No one else is producing it, and they're very proud of what they're doing. To me, that's a model that works because it lowers the cost for the newspapers and the TV stations, which essentially work as distribution outlets or conduits, and allow a studio, which is an organization of ferment, of real lively action, to grow. And I'd like to see that develop as a model more widely. Yeah.
My name's George Dunn. Actually, I'm in the midst of setting up a small publishing company, which probably is pretty close, at least from our ideas at this moment now, what you're talking about. And we are wondering about this exact question. How can you incorporate kind of a basic funding from something like a Kickstarter campaign or a foundation-funded problem is when foundations give you money, it's always about, well, is this for the public benefit or not? And if you say, well, in the long run, we want to make money, like you described in your studio approach, then they won't give you any money. So you're back to going to the bank and asking for loans there. So do you think that this kind of model could actually work? And is this how the Center for Investigative Reporting works, that they have some basic funding from well-meaning philanthropists, and apart from that, they are just capitalists?
Well, it is working in the U.S., and it's fairly stable at this point. So on an investigative level, which is more of a national state or a national level, there are probably three bigger companies or organizations, all nonprofits, and then a number of statewide ones, which are run by, you know, three, four people here and there. And their model largely has been get foundations to fund you at the beginning close to 100%. The foundations will say, and they are nonprofits, the foundations will say, you got 3 years of funding, then you got to figure it out. Well, they're ending the 3 years now, and they haven't figured it out. They've maybe added 20-30% of their, getting 20-30% of their funding from somewhere else. These foundations in the U.S. at least are saying, that's okay. We're glad you are getting money from other places. We want to see more of that. And if you can show a trajectory over time where you can move from 20-30% to 50% and 60%, if the foundation part of what we have to give is decreases over time and we built something with you, we're happy about that. We're kind of in year three and year four of that, so we're not sure where it's going to go. Now, Global Post is actually a for-profit company, but it's not yet profitable. So it's not gotten foundation money, or it didn't get foundation money at the beginning. It is now going after foundation money as well and starting to get some for specific projects. So this distinction between nonprofit and profit is another thing that's starting to blur, where foundations are starting to give money and grants to for-profit companies, including daily newspapers, to do specific projects. So at least that's how it's working in the U.S. I think this model of you got the foundations on the one hand. So you've got to answer the question, what need are you serving? And I assume you have answered that kind of question. We're doing this, and this is an underserved need in our area, in our audience, in our market. If that seems to resonate as you talk to people, then that's the most important thing. Well, if it's underserved, maybe you can talk foundations into some early funding. But then there's that question of big media companies. And I know what's happened in Germany, even especially over the last 12 months, double-digit losses in print advertising now at newspapers. I don't know whether the culture has yet developed here, for instance, where newspaper companies are saying, we don't want to continue cutting staff, but we don't have any choice, right? They're still cutting staff. They're cutting newsroom staff. We need more content. Are they saying we're willing to work with third-party organizations of journalists as long as the content meets our standards? That's what I see developing very strongly in the United States now, so that you'd have a newspaper or a magazine company, and magazines for a long time have hired stringers, of course. But now we're talking about small companies or studios, and say, the studio says to a magazine or newspaper, we can give you 12 stories next year. And the cost to you will be a third of what it would be if you were using your full-time staff to produce those stories. We will produce those stories to the same level of quality that you do. Now, there would be skepticism, and there was skepticism in the U.S. when this started. But what's proven is that this is working, and the media companies now are essentially paying smaller journalism studios to create content. So I would urge you to look at that aspect as well. And if it's a newer model in Germany, it'll take a little while, and what it really takes is doing one or two or three stories of real, you know, of high quality, and that trust that develops. And then you have that as a revenue source, in addition to foundations, in addition to advertising, in addition to the community aspect of saying to people, this is what we do, we are asking you to support it on a voluntary basis.
Well, I'd say in general, the majority of German media companies are still reluctant to try this sort of new cooperation model other than employing freelancers. There are some exceptions that come to my mind, but it's still at the very beginning and 4 or 5 years behind the U.S. Yeah. And CIR, they did something else very interesting. They did not only sell content to the Bay Area media entities, but they also got them to cooperate.
Right.
They then worked together to make the story, to write follow-ups, to make the story go on. And I think they changed a mindset that former competitors became collaborators, and everyone won in this situation.
Yeah.
You see this as a model?
Oh, absolutely. And that has been a very important part of their model. One of their best series was called On Shaky Ground, which was, I live in California, and we know that another big earthquake will happen. And, of course, you cannot predict an earthquake. So a reporter at CIR found a source who said, I've been looking at these records, somebody in state government, and it looks like a lot of these schools that we're sending our kids to are going to crumble if the big one happens to hit during the school day. And so we're kind of betting that the big one won't hit during the school day, which didn't seem like a really smart idea to this reporter. Ended up doing a project that was a Pulitzer finalist And as you're saying, what they did with that is they extended it. They not only placed the story in media across the state, TV, newspaper, radio, ethnic press, but they localized. And they allowed the local journalists to localize. So they said, we've done all the data. We got the data out of the state. Here's the data. But if you are in Orange County, here's your data. So here's your data. We could, and I don't know if they did this, but this is the easiest the way you can see it developed. And they could say, we will crunch the local data for you. It'll cost you a little extra because it's going to take extra time. Or we'll give you the data and you can crunch it yourselves. So the ability to work with those journalists is developing over time. And this, it doesn't surprise me that it's not happening in Germany yet, and I haven't seen it in UK either. 5 years ago, if you had told me that CIR could succeed with what they're doing in California, I would have said you were crazy. But the stress on the press is such that if you can find the right person in that press organization, and especially a lot of this is relationship. So many people have left the traditional press. And if you have someone who's left, who is now working with a new organization, they still have that credibility. So I think it can develop, and I think it's very much worth pushing on that model of what has worked, and CIR is about the best in the world that I've seen.
ProPublica does this too.
ProPublica does it.
I think their Dollars for Docs data was distributed over more than 100 local news organizations. And you mentioned scale before, but isn't ProPublica an example that you can do a lot of good journalistic work with very few people? I think they have something like 30 editors and reporters.
Yeah, I think that's right. They have about 30 plus. But 30 is enough. But what I meant by scale, especially on any level, but on a local level, in a San Diego, without foundation funding, Voice of San Diego might be able to afford four people. Four people's not enough, right? And even in San Diego, you really need 8 to 10, second largest city in California. So 30 is enough for ProPublica, well used, and with all their distribution. The larger problem here is local, I think, for the news industry. That on a national level, because you have the ability to scale distribution, whether it's ProPublica or newspapers, national levels are challenging but more doable. You can make more money to support it and attract more money. It is more difficult on that local level to get to that scale of journalism using a new model.
Is scale maybe something that we know from the old industrial age? If you have a large newsroom like the New York Times, it's maybe one of the biggest with still up to 1,000 staffers.
1,150.
Yeah. You need scale. But in digital, there are a lot of things you don't need to do and a lot of jobs that are not necessary anymore. Someone, and I don't remember who this was, put up this calculation that if the New York Times stopped the printing presses, they would only need 700 staffers. And 700 is about what they can afford with their digital revenue. So is there a time for any news company when they must carefully think about, this is the time that we push that lever and stop the printing presses? Because they cost us more than they earn us?
We're still pretty far away from that. So it's 20.
There's the media company Digital First that doesn't think we're that far away. John Patton doesn't think
Their numbers tell you they're far away, no matter what John says. if Digital First cut off its printing tomorrow, it would have to cut its newsrooms by about 3/4. So we're pretty far away from that. Now, if you take your example. When I'm talking about scale, I'm talking about just scale of journalists. So you have kind of two questions about newspaper companies. I ran some numbers last year, which surprised me and then surprised others when I published them, and said that the average, these were U.S. numbers, of the total expenses of a daily newspaper company in the U.S., on average, 12.8% was going to the newsroom. So one out of $8 going there, 12%. it was an amazing number. So it is always true that people in the newsroom have an underappreciation of people in other parts of their building, but it is equally true that in a digital age, you wouldn't need production, printing, distribution. And of course, you should have a smaller finance department if you're taking in so much less money. So we have seen cuts in other parts of the building, but if I focus on a newsroom, what I'm talking about in terms of scale is it's very different having an independent individual journalist, no matter how good they are or how well known they are, as compared to a news brand that an audience knows over time. So the scale I'm talking about is a scale of journalists, as differently than the size of a newspaper company. Inside of the newspaper company, sizes are taking care of themselves. They're going down rapidly at this point. What I'm concerned about is the preservation of journalistic scale, which gives audiences a handle to hold on to, and also means, and all of us who are journalists understand this deeply, that when you're doing reporting, if you are individual or independent, it can often be a lot harder getting access than if you're part of an organization that is known and respected. And the balance of power in the societies in which we live across the Western democracies has really changed. What's happened, I think, is that in this tremendous loss of revenue, this 39% loss around the globe, but higher in Europe and higher in the U.S., we've seen a parallel loss in confidence, that journalists believe they are in an end of a profession that is in decline, and they act that way, and their publishers can act that way, when in fact we don't have an audience problem by every metric. The audience is growing. It's a revenue problem. But that loss in confidence means that the powers that we cover, largely government and business, have more of an upper hand on the press. The press needs to be out there in a democracy as a very strong, proud, unfortunately sometimes arrogant, counterweight to power. And what we've seen is a loss in that power, a loss in that confidence. So when I come back to scale and size, it's important to me that as I look at our democratic institutions 5 and 10 years from now, they're supported by strong press groups. Now they're reorganized, renamed perhaps, but I think they're groups more than they're individuals because of that counterweight needed in society.
Of course, then there are some journalists who've become their own brands, broke away.
Yeah, a few.
Andrew Sullivan, Nate Silver, who became famous as a number cruncher in the elections. David Pogue from the New York Times, he could go it alone.
Yeah.
But I agree, these are
It's a dozen. Yeah. It's two dozen. It's not what we need to cover a city.
But could newspapers get back to scale by collaborating in more intelligent ways with the public, and by doing so also, especially in the U.S., regain some of the trust that they've lost?
Yeah, I think it's a huge frontier. And I was talking with Annette Novak about it last night. We were talking about experiments like Gazeta in Warsaw, when Gazeta grew out of the Solidarity movement and has always been a mission-driven newspaper. They know why they're there. They remember what Poland was like before 1989, and they knew that their role wasn't to report the news simply, but was to build democracy. Well, democracy is not exactly a thriving thing across the West at this point. The idea of rebuilding democracy, rebuilding our communities and our society and meeting all the challenges that are out there. I have increasingly, as I do work with newspapers, I'm increasingly urging them to find a very strong community role that they are comfortable with. And that gives purpose to what they do. News reporting, investigative reporting is the core of what it is to be a journalist. But the core of what it is to be a news organization is to do that reporting in the service of community. And the only way you can do that is to engage more with the community to figure out what those challenges are and not just write a story and go back to the office. Unfortunately, we have relatively few examples of that. The digital tools that are at our service at this point only make that a lot easier and a lot cheaper, but they have not yet been well harnessed. I hope that we are on the brink of that next era of some companies proving out that model.
Jeff Jarvis calls this a journalism as a service. Living in New Jersey, which was hit hard by Hurricane Sandy, he complained about his local paper, saying that didn't do him any service in that kind of situation, just giving him stories of something that anybody with eyes and ears could have discovered themselves, but being useful to people in need would have been a good service. What I think, if you are a platform that people can use as a service and you give them news you can use, you really form a strong tie with your community. But then, can you still put up a paywall? Because aren't you then making the public pay twice? You're asking them to help you, and then you're asking them to pay for everything that's behind the paywall.
I don't see that. I don't see that distinction in terms of the paywall. I mean, paywall. The way paywalls work is that you still have a relatively small percentage of the community that is willing to pay and values it. I think if a newspaper is doing even more public service, those who are paying for it are going to feel better about it because they know that it's doing more for their community. I think, you know, it's in that mindset of journalists in terms of that service mentality. If there is a disaster, some news organizations respond better. You go to the Times-Picayune newspaper in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, did some wonderful service work. They understood what people wanted to know and what they could do that individuals couldn't do. The hard part of this is that newspaper people, over time, are kind of big story junkies. We all know how to respond. We get trained of how to respond to a big story. The question is, in a New Orleans, for instance, right now, is you have a terrible storm, death, destruction. So now we have a rebuilding story in New Orleans. And so for instance, education. Incredible education story in New Orleans. New Orleans had about the worst educational system of any urban educational system in the U.S. The remaking of that system and how it involves parents and how it involves teachers is a story that is not being well told. So that idea of service as an ongoing way to connect up with education issues, immigration issues, health issues, to really map the community, that's a lot harder work, and it doesn't come out of the most journalist DNA.
So are you saying that we need more network journalism, media working together to serve?
Yeah, I mean, I think media at its best is a community organizer as well as a reporter of news. The ability to draw people together to help solve problems and get people to a table is unparalleled. And so, yes, it should be a news organization should be, and again, why it would need scale, it should be the center of a network. It should be a nerve center of what is happening in any city. The service aspect, I was a features editor a long time ago, and we talked about service. So what's service? Well, how do I find a good restaurant? How do I find the right home improvement people, right? Those kind of things. You know, that's service journalism. Well, what about service journalism? There's a certain kind of service journalism that is still amazingly undone, which is a city guide. Now, in a purely commercial sense, when somebody arrives in Hamburg, Stockholm, where do you go to find out information about what's happening? What's the database? And how come there's not a city guide city by city by city in Europe or in the U.S.? It's 2013. No one has even created a city guide. Well, a city guide model, which should work commercially, somebody will end up doing this, I'm hoping, by 2018. But it also works for networking education. So what's the education map of Hamburg? How does it work? Where is it strong? Where is it weak? Because until you can identify the strengths and weaknesses, you can't work on those problems, which is very different than writing a story about the budget of the school system and how it's undergoing change. So it's a different level of thinking about what a news organization will be, and I'm hoping it comes out of, we have a lot of new ownership of newspapers in the U.S., and they're largely non-newspaper people, which is probably a good thing. What Jeff Bezos is going to do in Washington, no one quite knows. I'm pretty enthused about what may happen on the marketing end, but on this community end, I don't know what he sees. There are other people like Aaron Kushner in Orange County, and if you want to look at one of the most interesting examples of what's happening in the U.S., look at the Orange County Register, which is adopting a pro-community attitude, but I haven't, and they're doing a lot more stuff for the community, but I haven't seen them do a lot more stuff with the community, but it's only been a year. But I think it's absolutely right, and that is a track that could not only revive the financial fortunes of media, but the respect and esteem of news media going forward.
Right here in Hamburg, Hamburger Abendblatt started a project a year ago that could have been really interesting. To my mind, they wasted some great chances. Yeah. They did something called a platform called Everything About Your Street. And they had had reporters going out for a whole year, and they put in a database 8,000 local streets and valued them by, rated them by how high is the rent, how good are the schools, shopping, public transport, noise, everything. And they could have had a much better data and much better involvement if they had included the community, which they didn't. No, they didn't include the community at all. Afterwards, the community could rate the work the reporters did, but not they couldn't really put up the data themselves. And then they put it behind the paywall. Then they realized big blunder, so they took it out of the paywall. But it's static. It's not involving, mistakes aren't being corrected. I mean, the experts live in these streets.
Right.
And like, people complain, no, it's not the subway line 3 that goes by my house, it's subway line 1. Please correct
right.
that.
Right.
Nobody corrects right. this. So there are experiments, but still a long way to go.
There have been a lot of experiments, but you're right, they stop. And it's, you use that example. That's why we're talking about yesterday, Wikipedia for cities. Well, if you take that approach and you say, and it's fine, okay, let the newspaper seed this database, right? And create the database, hopefully make it visually easy to use.
No visuals, no maps.
Right? Well, this is like a 1999 idea, unfortunately, right? Every block did this in the United States, and they would take all the public records about Chicago and put them in all one place, and it was the most boring thing you could look at. But now we have all those tools. Now, if you take that and you give it to the city and you have a couple of people working on it, working with the community, and saying, we want you to populate this and use Wikipedia kind of tools, and, of course, edit it over time, exactly that mapping of the city with its transit routes, its schools, its school stores, its school scores, you know, its restaurants, all of that moves into a database. I actually have never heard of that happening in a city of essentially creating a city wiki along those bases to a large degree.
That'd be great.
So it's right out there.
I just have a comment concerning the Hamburger Abendblatt thing that you just mentioned, because as far as I know, it was a top-down decision to do this, and I basically heard reporters complaining that they didn't want to do this. So it's always about having the right people too,
yes.
And that
yes.
brings to mind something that I think Michael Menis, is it, who was talking at the Scoop Camp a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that the problem in the news industry is a lack of innovation, of innovative spirit in leadership. I'd just like to know your thoughts about that.
It is very and obviously true, I think. There's been a lack of vision. And I think it comes out of, it's a pretty old-fashioned conservative trait. And what we've gotten, instead of enthusiasm for what could be because of the digital age, is this more of the sense of loss. The encouragement that I'm seeing with these new owners, like in Orange County, or what I'm seeing in Orange County is the same thing I'm seeing at the Center for Investigative Reporting. When you go there, there's a different tone. So if the Umblot idea came up there, I think you would have enough people who would say, huh, that's interesting. How might we do that? As opposed to the 16 reasons why I don't want to do it or it's not a good idea. That's what we need. And, you know, by the nature of the way the world works, many of the people who were standing in the way are out of the profession. But we do need new leadership and ownership and leadership. And we also need people who are generally younger people, not entirely, but generally younger people standing up and saying, I think we ought to do this, we ought to try this, we ought to break these bounds. And it's going to take proving out some models. It's very interesting when you look at things, and the most recent one would be paywalls. So whatever you think of paywalls, the rapid adoption of paywalls is really interesting. In 2010, New York Times put one up, and before that, very few general interest newspapers put them up. I think Springer did about the same time in Hamburg and Berlin. There were very few that were doing it. Now there are more than 500. I think the ability of good ideas, not just paywalls, but good journalistic and community-involving ideas, can spread like wildfire. But we need to see some of them getting started. People are looking for answers. Yeah.
Thanks. All the examples you have just, or a lot of the examples you have just elaborated on, they focus on local media or even hyper-local media with all this community involvement. I was wondering, do you also have any good examples of things like that working on the level of special interest of magazine journalism, topics like science, technology, economics, you know, stuff for the big nice magazines, which of course are also having economical troubles?
Sure, and so I'll give you one really good example. Look at Atlantic Media Company. So Atlantic Media Company is a very interesting company. The Atlantic Magazine started in 1857, and it's based in Boston. It was an abolitionist magazine. This is a magazine with deep, deep roots in American history. I read when I was a kid in high school and college, it was a magazine of ideas, but it really hadn't changed much in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. David Bradley bought it in 1999. And if you go to their page, go to atlanticmedia.com, you will see 6 or 7 different brands there now. They're actually starting a new branded journalism site every year. And one of the most interesting ones is Quartz. So Quartz is QZ.com. They don't have an app. It's only HTML5. It is a mobile-first global business news site. And the way they started this site was to say to their naysayers said, there's plenty of business news out there. It's dominated by the Journal, Financial Times, you know, Thomson Reuters, Bloomberg. And they said, no, there's a different way to do business news and to try to answer questions that people have about what are the major things really going on in business today, and we're going to hire the best writers from The Economist, the FT, and others, hired a staff of about 25. This is a really interesting example of taking a niche, which is an old niche, which seemed like it was too crowded and filled with giants, and they are profitable, and they're doing great journalism. So it's a redefinition. Politico has done the same thing in terms of national politics and national government news in Washington, D.C. You also have on a regional level TechWire, WRAL, which is a TV station does a tech site for the state of North Carolina. So you can even do tech on a regional basis. But the playbook is all fairly similar. It's what Ulrike is saying about small, too. You don't have to be that big, but you do need to have 6 or 10 or 20. And you need to have really good people. You have good people, keep your costs very low, so your non-journalism people, and you look at these numbers, and as you start your business, if in daily newspapers 12% of the resources are going to journalists, in these new companies and new organizations, it's usually 75 or 80%. So you need salespeople to sell ads or sponsorships. You need to count whatever money you can get in the door. You need to run an office. There are basic things you need to do. But you're changing the whole dynamic, and you're saying, this is a journalism organization. 3/4 of people are journalists. We have the other people, and you hire really smart business people to do some business development and partnerships. You do that. You do mobile first. You're not doing print largely. You're keeping your costs low. And there are a lot of examples like that, but I would look at Atlantic Media as one of the best. They have 3 or 4 other publications that fit that playbook, and they've got it. They've got it down at this point.
I have been shown the warning sign that we're running out of time. Maybe one last remark from you, if you're more optimistic or more pessimistic for the future of journalism.
Well, I'm a congenital optimist, so it's an unfair question, but there's no doubt we've had tremendous loss, and it's loss that's uncountable. We know less because there are fewer journalists telling us things that are going on, even doing basic news reporting. In the U.S., we've lost 30% of daily journalists. Europe is probably 15 to 20% right now. So there is a tremendous loss. There is a sadness to that. But I think as long as we are able to engage with the kinds of ideas that we are talking about today here, that journalism and some of the early and successful models, and see those expanded, I think the journalism of the next 10 years could be far better than it was 20 years ago. So there's no doubt that the quality is going to be there, and I can see pockets of quality in a number of the organizations and companies I've talked about. I get back to that question of scale. I want to see lots more of these kinds of good things happening across the world. And what we now have is seedlings that are starting here and there, but people have figured out both how to do it right in terms of journalism and somewhat business model. They haven't figured out community yet, but I think that's the next frontier, and I think that will help provide glue for the whole process.
I'm sure we could go on for at least a couple of hours more, but let's end this on this optimistic note, and let's give a warm round of applause for Ken Doctor.
This is the User Experience Hamburg Radio. Thanks for listening. Visit the UXHH-radio.blogspot.de for more live recordings.